Welcome. I'd like to call the meeting to order and welcome to our seventh speaker in this series for this season. Can't hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay. Welcome to our seventh speaker in this series for this season. And if you would, any of you have a cell phone, please turn it off. And I think I got mine on. I got mine on, so mine turned off now. This is not on purpose. This is really an accident. Okay. Thank you again for coming. And our next speaker, I want to remind you, is on March 21st, again in this room, Bill Plant, who's a CBS News White House correspondent and should have some interesting things to say. I'd like to introduce our invocation speaker today, and it's Reverend Lisa Lefko, Habitat from Humanity. Lisa?
Good afternoon, members of the Forum Club and honored guests. It's always great to be with you as we gather together for this day. Each time that I've been invited to be with you all, I've worked to find some connection between the work that I do at Habitat for Humanity and the vocation of our honorable speaker. Today, I'm pleased to tell you that this day has been brought to you by the letter R. As we have an alliterative association, Mr. Young, you and I, while you have spent a lifetime riding rails, I spend my work raising roofs. I've been doing an informal survey as we've been gathering together, and I'm sure that many of you, like me, have stories of ancestors or predecessors that were involved in the railroad. And if not, every one of us has some old railroad story from our growing up years. And it is certainly with my great thanks that we honor your contribution to this industry that has provided the foundation of our country's growth and development. So good to be with you. Will you join your hearts with mine in a spirit of prayer? Creator and creative God, we thank you for the many and the powerful ways that you are at work in our community, in our nation, and in our world. Today, we would ask that our hearts and our minds might be open to an expanded awareness of this world, that through our deeper understanding and heightened sensitivity, we might find new and challenging ways to make a difference. We thank you for the gifts and graces that you have invested in each one here gathered, for the work that has been accomplished, and for the opportunities that lie ahead. As the rails of our country have opened lines of distribution and communication, may we be ever mindful that we are members of a global neighborhood. Fortify us to break down the walls and barriers of misunderstanding, prejudice, and assumptions so that we can better speak and listen to one another. And now, Lord, we ask your blessing upon this meal, remembering the labor that has gone into it, from the fields to the kitchen. May it strengthen and nourish us as we share in the blessing of Abraham, that we might indeed be a blessing to others. And all God's people said, Amen.
Thank you, Lisa. Now I'd like to call on Wade Keller, who's chairs our student guest program. And Wade, I'll turn it over to you to introduce your students.
Okay. Greetings, everyone. Our students today, our student guests are from PACE, and one of the sponsors, Pat Barton, tells me that PACE stands for Practical Academic Cultural Education. It's over 20 years old, and it's the number one program in Florida. It's a statewide program for at-risk girls. And let me first, girls, would you please join me here on the podium? Come on up now. They're scattered about a little bit. Here we go. And as you're coming up, I'd like to thank our sponsors today. Midge, we have two sponsors for the program. Midge Voss Midge has been in Naples for 32 years, and she is a strong admirer of the PACE program. And also Pat Boughton, who has been the board chair of PACE for 8 years. She's also served on the state board of PACE, and she has chaired a capital campaign for PACE that raised $6.2 million recently. So, Midge and Pat, would you please stand and let us thank you for your sponsorship. Now I'll introduce the girls one at a time, and they're going to take 1 minute each to tell you about their plans for the future and their achievements. And Josephina Laura. Josephina, would you go first, please?
I'm a little nervous. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Josephina Lara. I am 17 years old. I was born in Naples, Florida, and I have two brothers and three sisters. Their names are Annie, Maria, Crystal, Eddie. I have lived in Milwaukee my entire life. My hobbies include playing football and tetherball. I love sports. I attend PACE Center for Girls in Immokalee, which is a private school for girls. Every day after school, I go to work, RCMA, which is a child care. My vocational goals is to have my own business and to be a cosmetologist. I would like to have my own salon in Immokalee. This way, I can continue to help my family and to be a positive role model for other young people in my community. Thank you.
Very good. Good job. Right. And next, okay, a little bit closer to the microphone when you come up. Next, Maria Pasquale. Maria, speak right into the microphone.
I'm Maria Pasquale. I'm a graduating high school senior. I am from a family consisting of 5 children. Both of my parents were born and raised in Guatemala. My mother attended school for 2 years, and my father never had the opportunity to attend school. They decided to come to the United States for a better life. I plan to attend either Florida Gulf Coast University, located in Fort Myers, Florida, or Florida International University, located in Miami, Florida. I decided to remain in Florida because it is important for me to stay close to my family and friends. I am in need of a scholarship because my parents cannot afford to send me to a university. My father is currently working for a landscaping company, and my mother is picking bolitas, a berry used for cancer research. I have studied very hard to attain my high level of success and cherish the opportunity to continue my formal education. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me. God bless.
Right. And next, Irene Rodriguez. Okay, Irene.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Irene, and I am a senior at PACE Center for Girls in Immokalee. I have been a student at PACE for 3.5 years. While attending PACE, I set several goals for myself. These goals include finishing school and receiving my diploma. I will then continue my education and major in cosmetology with hopes of one day owning my own business. I am currently looking at several vocational schools in Florida that offer cosmetology, including Lorenzo Walker Institute of Technology and Sun State Academy. Thank you.
And next, Karen Segura. Karen.
My name is Karen, and I'm 18 years old, and I'm a senior at PACE Center for Girls. My plan is to attend Florida International University in Miami and major in photojournalism, with one day hoping to have my own magazine and travel the world.
Oh, Okay. You did good. You did good. And last is Vanessa Martinez.
You can correct.
Okay. Hi, my name is Vanessa Martinez. I'm 16 years old and a senior at Pace Center for Girls. I plan to become a psychiatrist. I come from a single-parent home. My parents divorced when I was 3 months old. I am the youngest of four children, three girls and one boy. I want to become a psychiatrist to be a role model for my niece and nephews and to help out the community. I would like to be able to make a fairly well income to buy my mom her own house so she doesn't have to worry about any bills because she's done enough by raising us. My goal after graduating high school is to attend FGCU for my freshman and sophomore years to be close to my home. For my junior and senior years, I would love to attend Nova University. And at this time, I actually have a scholarship with the Bright Future Scholarships that pay for about 50% of my tuitions. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, go back to sit down now.
Thank you, young ladies, for some very inspiring remarks. Commence your lunch now, and if you haven't already, and we'll continue with our program in about 30 minutes. Thank you. Hello. How's dessert? Is dessert okay? Dessert was okay. Thumbs up. Start the program now, and if you would continue your meal if you haven't finished. I would like to introduce a member of our club who's responsible for inviting our guest today and was successful in securing his agreement to be here on this day and brought some nice weather with him, and also welcomed his wife, Shirley. David Rissmiller. David, if you would come forward. David introduced our speaker to our lights meeting, too. He's getting to be a ritual here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. Forum Club members and guests, I'm real happy to be here again today and introduce our speaker. And you've read a little of his bio, but Jim is president, chairman, and CEO of the Union Pacific Corp and the Union Pacific Railroad. I'll talk a little bit about the railroad and a few things about Jim. The interesting thing is I need my glasses. All of a sudden I realized I forgot something. Today in trackage, the Union Pacific is the largest in the United States with over 33,000 miles of trackage. That's quite a bit. Another unique thing, this railroad was formed July 1, 1862 by an act of Congress, not the normal way a company is formed, an act of Congress. President Lincoln, he was concerned about California joining the Confederacy, and this might be a way to get California as part of the Union. And so what happened, and many of you know that story, where the Union Pacific pushed west along the Platte River Valley and the Central Pacific came from the West Coast, and then you had the historic joining in Provo, Utah in 1869. And by the way, by telegraph, this was the first event that was, quote, broadcast nationally in our country. Today, the railroad is a combination of at least 19 mergers and acquisitions, Central Pacific, Southern Pacific, Missouri Pacific, Western Pacific, a lot of Pacific, Chicago, Northwestern, Denver, and Rio Grande, to name a few. Again, I want to mention culture. You want to try to meld cultures of 19 different railroads with all those unions and all those management teams. That's quite an accomplishment, isn't it? Our speaker is a University of Nebraska graduate, degree in accounting. He's a Nebraska native, stayed with the railroad, who's headquartered in Omaha, Nebraska. 1978, Jim graduates from University of Nebraska. He has a couple interviews. And there are two different companies that he thinks are going to make him an offer. One is Union Pacific, and the other is, are you ready? The forerunner of Enron. It was a different name then. And so Jim and Shirley said, and I learned this part last night, whichever one calls first, I think I'll take that job. Is that a true story? Union Pacific called on Friday and Enron the following Monday. Many of you have heard this song. Remember the song, I've been working on the railroad? Well, Jim's been working on the railroad ever since. He's done many things, as the saying goes, learned the business from the ground up. You read his bio. The most recent job he had before coming president of the railroad was as a chief financial officer, again, a numbers guy. He became president of railroad in 2004, president and CEO of UP Corporation in 2005, and added the chairman title in January 2007. He's the 30th CEO in railroad history. And most of his predecessors were railroad operations people. Jim, again, is a numbers guy, and I think the results that have happened since he took over are very evident of his background. Today, the company is 151st on the Fortune 500, and around 53,000 employees. 53,000 employees. He finds time to stay at home a little bit, although he travels about 60% of the time doing a multitude of different things, everything from government relations to employee meetings throughout the field. He tries to take the information from headquarters to the field and listen to employees, and that's what a CEO's job is all about, and he certainly personifies that. I should ask for a show of hands, but I'm not going to do it. What I want to ask you is, first of all, I assume many of you own shares in the Union Pacific Corp. I hope, one person said I do, I hope all of you do, because under Jim's leadership, November 2005, when he became president and CEO, the stock price was $71 a share. Yesterday's close was $121 a share. That's a 71% increase. Market cap when he took over, $18.5 billion. Market cap now is about $32, $33 billion. That's quite a record. And I personally feel, this is no advice from the chairman, I think at today's price it's a great buy. So it's now my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Jim Young.
Good afternoon, everyone. How does it sound back there? Can you hear me okay in back? I'll do a sound check here. I always have to watch that. My wife wears a hearing aid. She will shoot me for saying this, but she's reminded me many times, speak up. So hopefully you can hear me today. It's really an honor to be here to speak to the Forum Club. We had a board of directors meeting here about 2 weeks ago, and I had mentioned to our board members that I would be in Florida speaking to the Forum Club. And two of them jumped up and said, what a great organization. So we had the discussion back in Omaha, Nebraska. Now, it wasn't a hard sell. A couple weeks ago when David and Ellen, we had a conference call to talk about what they wanted me to speak about, I was sitting in my office in Omaha, Nebraska. The temperature was, I think, 3 degrees, and the wind chill was 25 below. So coming to Florida was really not a tough sell for me. What we're going to do today, we're going to talk about railroads. And as David mentioned, we have a long history, just celebrated our 145th anniversary last year. David had mentioned when I was promoted, it really struck me when our head of public relations came in and said, congratulations, Jim, you're the 30th president of Union Pacific. And it was a real honor to me to be named chairman of the company. You've got a little handout here in terms of some visual aids that I want to follow today to help you understand our business a little bit. What you're going to hear me talk about is this is an industry that has gone through several transitions over its 145-year timeline. UP has been through two bankruptcies. In fact, Union Pacific was bought back in the late 1800s on the steps of a freight house in downtown Omaha by H. Harriman. That freight house today is now our nerve center to operate the railroad. It's been there over, again, 145 years. We've got about $100 million of technology in there. It controls our network. We have gone from it. Let me ask you a question here. How many of you have ridden on a passenger train sometime in your life? You bet. Look. Now, if I was over at the local university and asked that question, few would raise their hands. because there's been a huge transition, as you have known, in terms of the railroad industry. We have very little passenger business on the railroad today in terms of what we're handling here. I'm going to talk here in a minute about that, though. I have many mayors in the cities that I operate in today that want to start new commuter operations, passenger business on the railroad. The problem is it doesn't work. So why don't we get started here? You've got the exhibits there in front of you. Many people don't understand what the freight railroads really mean personally in terms of day-to-day lives. Reverend, I've got a connection for you. You had mentioned the connection to roofs, railroads and roofs. Well, the connection is we handle that lumber. We handle the construction materials that came to help build those houses. But if you'll see here, when you got up this morning, you flipped on your light. That electricity probably was generated from a coal plant that the railroads hauled. When you turn on your television set or your computer to find out the daily news, that piece of equipment was probably handled in a container coming from Asia that the railroads held. And in fact, the plastic pellets that went into producing that material and soda ash that went into producing was handled by a railroad. The automobile you drove in here today, Union Pacific handles 80% of the finished vehicles west of the Mississippi. It was handled by a railroad, as were most of the parts that went into building that that automobile. Your lunch today, fertilizers, lettuce, beef, chickens, all handled by railroads in the United States here. And finally, when you took that drink of water this morning, the purification, the chlorine that's used to purify water was handled by a railroad. My point is, we do touch your lives every day when you think about the railroad business. Many people don't understand that. Now, we'll start here with some fast facts. I'm on slide two. If you look at the U.S. freight railroads, there's really four major railroads left in the United States. They stop at the Mississippi River. You have two in the east, which is CSX and Norfolk Southern. You have two in the west, which is Union Pacific and the other guys in Fort Worth, my competitors, Burlington Northern. There are two in Canada and two in Mexico. So there has been a huge consolidation over time in terms of the railroad industry. But I would tell you that this is a great time to be in the railroad business in terms of demand for our services here. We operate in 23 states, 7,000 communities. Our interchange points are Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis, New Orleans. We own 26% of the Ferromex Railroad in Mexico, but split our business about evenly. We operate in all the major ports. If you look at the slide there, you'll see all the major West Coast ports, all the major interchange points into Mexico. We handle about 80% of the business into Mexico. Now, if you look at the third slide here, you'll get a snapshot of our business. It's well-balanced. Gives our company some protection against cycles in the business world. I'll give you an example today. 2.5 years ago when you had the, and I know you see this down here in Florida, when the housing market was so hot, you couldn't build houses fast enough. We were short equipment to haul lumber out of Canada and the Pacific Northwest. I had customers calling me. I had senators calling me. We weren't handling their business fast enough. In fact, I was short 500, 600, 700 carloads a day. Today, I have 4,000 flat cars that we use to haul lumber sitting in storage. They've been in storage for 2 years, and we're continuing to put them in storage. So we have seen the cycle there that has been huge. That's a huge investment for it. It's a couple hundred million dollars that's sitting idle right now. On the other side, how many of you have read about ethanol? Out in Iowa and Nebraska, it is a huge production for them. In fact, about 60% of the corn produced in Nebraska now is going into the production of ethanol. 3 years ago, ethanol was a $25 million a year business for us. This year, we're going to end up probably booking about $300 million. So we've got a good diverse business mix as we go forward here. Last year, now here's a great stat. I had them check it a couple times because I had to look at the math here, just talking about some of the different products we haul. Last year, Union Pacific moved over 1.5 billion of French fries. And here's an even better one. We moved 4 billion bottles of beer to wash them down. Now, I did the math on that. That's about 12 bottles of beer for every man, woman, and child in the United States. What's that say about consumption here? But we are a big part. Our agricultural products business is about a $2.5 billion business and been very, very important to us going forward here. Now, we often describe, I describe our business as a 33,000-mile factory that's out in the open. We battle elements every day. We're very visible in the communities here. We operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We operate up in the Sierra Nevadas all the way to the Mojave Desert. It's one of the reasons I'm very proud of our 50,000 employees. These are tough, demanding jobs that you work hard and you are in all the elements. If you look at slide four, gives you some perspective. Actually, gives you some perspective why I'm happy to be here today in terms of the weather we've had up north. But these are some of the recent photos of the challenges that Mother Nature has brought to us this year. The photo on the top was taken a month ago in Truckee, California, when the snowfall there stood at 250 inches. It's about 21 feet. We've had one of the record winters out in the west this year. We basically are plowing snow about every 3 hours to keep the railroad open up there. If you look at the bottom right, you'll see a mudslide here happen up in Oregon. I'll never forget this phone call. I got a call about January 3rd. The phone used to sit on my wife's side. I think she's thinking at night moving over to my side because when I get a call late, it's nothing good. But I had a call from our operations folks up there, and they said, we've got a major problem up in Oregon. And in effect, what happened, we had the side of a mountain slide down. It was on January 3rd. We've been working 24/7. Looks like we may have it open on April 1st. We've had to reroute about 30 trains a day. To give you a feel for what the order of magnitude is here, it's 2.3 million cubic yards of materials, about 150,000 truckloads. And you're working on the side of a mountain in probably the worst weather you could think of right now. But I'm confident our men and women will get this thing reopened here. Now, that's just a couple months here in the history of a 146-year-old company. We're one of the oldest and most historically significant companies in America. We've got a great story to tell. As David mentioned, building the Transcontinental Railroad, selling the West to our current mission of building America to provide safe and efficient transportation for the American economy. Well, the nature of our business has always been pretty constant. We're in the service business, which I have to work with some of my operating teams to understand that customers, great service, that's success in a company here. But we've had a major shift over the last several years when you think about the shift of global production, manufacturing capability moving offshore. I was just out in Los Angeles, gave a speech Monday, had at the Trans-Pacific Maritime meeting. They had 1,300 people in the audience from all over the world. The number one question is this country going to keep up with transportation infrastructure going forward? And I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. If you look at slide five, this is a little bit of a color chart. I apologize. But really what you need to look at here is some of the key colors here. Red shows congested highways. Yellow shows some congestion, and green says it's okay. This was done in 2000. So if you look at it, you see some of the areas like California, Florida, a lot of the major metropolitan areas. Not a surprise to any of you. Flip over to the next slide. This is the projection out to 2020. So it's only about 12 years from now. What happens? California is just about in gridlock, and I will tell you, they're close. Again, the major issues they're facing in California in terms of capacity expansion are significant. You'll notice Florida's even a little bit of sunburned when you look down there in the bottom in terms of congestion going forward here. So what does it mean? It means we have a heck of a challenge here on transportation infrastructure. There have been five different studies that have been produced in the last 7 years that keep coming to the same conclusion. I kind of argued when I saw the last one, I don't need an expert to tell me we got a problem. But the issue is all you have to do is drive in the interstate system. Interstates are built in the 50s and 60s. Their time is due. This country is facing a major transportation crisis in infrastructure, whether it's railroads, highways, or ports. So if you look, in fact, the studies now conclude that we should be spending about $200 to $225 billion a year to start to make progress in terms of transportation capacity, and they believe we should spend it for the next 40, 50 years. Right now, the government and the state local folks are putting about 40% of that into transportation infrastructure. So we certainly have an issue long term here. Now, I get a lot of questions about passenger rail, putting more passengers on the railroad. I'm getting to know many of the mayors and all the communities operate very well. I was with the mayor of Fort Worth here a couple weeks ago. He invited me down. He had this great idea. I walked in the room. He had all of his transportation planners, and they had this map of Dallas-Fort Worth. And it looked like somebody had taken a magic marker and drew a line through the middle of the city. And he said, Jim, this is how we're going to solve our transportation problem in the cities of Dallas and Fort Worth. And I looked at that map, and I said, Mayor, that line's right over the Union Pacific Railroad. He said, that's right. We're going to add commuter rail right on top of your railroad. Unfortunately, I had to tell him delicately that wasn't going to work. But his point was they have a major crisis in that city in terms of expansion. And a lot of folks, if you travel to Europe, you'll know Europe, they have a very good passenger freight system. Unfortunately, in Europe, the system over there is about 80% passenger, 20% freight. In the United States, it's about 95% freight, 5% passenger. Now, why doesn't it work? Many people look at a railroad and they think, well, what's it really cost to add a few more trains, you know, in the morning, handle rush hour in the afternoon, take people back home? The problem that our industry has today is we're up against capacity. In fact, I'm going to show you a chart here in a minute in terms of what's happened in this business of one really going out of business several years to today, we're seeing significant growth. It doesn't work to add a few passenger slots on a railroad, because what happens when you're constrained? Let's say you're limited in number of trains you can run. If you take freight trains off, all you're doing is compounding your problem, because guess where that freight's moving? It's moving on the highways. And one of the things that we have to continue to work through as a country here is how are we going to solve this issue? I believe ultimately passenger can work, but our government's going to have to make some major policy changes in terms of how it's funded. To build a new mile of railroad, it's about $2.5 million a mile. To build a new mile of highway, it's almost four times that amount. If you look at the next chart here, slide 7, this gives you a little bit of history back about 30, 40 years ago in the railroad industry. Back in 1980, our industry was deregulated. They passed called the Staggers Act, and it allowed railroads to start to compete. Before that time, railroads were going broke. Simple as that. You had lines not being maintained. You had railroads being sold. We have many railroad lines today that are biking trails that, quite honestly, I wish I had them back today. But that was the impact of a regulated environment where the industry was not allowed to compete. If you look at what happened after 1980, you'll see a substantial increase in productivity, a substantial increase in terms of our revenue. And the bottom line was this. This was an industry that, quite honestly, I think they were between the railroads and probably steel industry were famous for feather bedding in terms of inefficiency. We had men on trains that had had the title of fireman. That was a job, which went back to the steam locomotive days, even though they were in a diesel electric locomotive. We had five people on a train in 1980. Today I have two. Bottom line, though, you can see what happened there. We're allowed to get more competitive, compete in the marketplace. We doubled the volume in the railroad industry. Employment went from 500,000 to 150,000. The number of miles outstanding shrunk 30%. It's a great success story in terms of what happens if you let businesses work and compete long term. If you want to flip to the next chart here, there's a different story we're trying to tell today on the railroad system. Part of my job is out communicating on the railroads, about the railroads. We all know about environmental issues. We know about railroad congestion. Folks out in California, although I won't pick on California, they have some different ideas how railroads should work and about emissions, but we're seeing this spread all over our system. If you take a look at that chart here, one of the things you can take a look at here, one train, I'll give you another fact here, one intermodal train. I always quiz my wife on trains when we're out in the driving around, saying, what kind of train is that? She knows coal train, grain train, double stack train. She does pretty good at it, but my granddaughter's getting pretty good at it too. But one double stack train. When you see a container train, you have two containers on it. It's 280 trucks off the highway. One load of lumber moving on a train. One carload of lumber is three trucks when you look at it moving on the highway here. I'm going to give you one fact here that if you remember anything in our industry going forward is this. You think about energy independence in our country today and what we need to try and do. The railroad industry today can haul one ton, 790 miles on 1 gallon of diesel. So think about that a minute. That would be the equivalent of your car getting about 800 miles per gallon. So that's one of the things that we look at in terms of energy independency and the importance of railroads going forward here. If you look at last year here, let me flip here to make certain I've got the right slide here. Flip over to the next slide for me. It's called Enterprise Risk Management. When I became chairman of the company about a year and a half ago, I'll never forget my first board meeting, and things have changed on being on a public board these days. Sarbanes-Oxley made things much more serious. People take their jobs much more focused in terms of what they do. Board meetings are much longer than they'd ever been. But my first meeting, our board, when we were done, and I get a performance review after every board, they said, Jim, what is it that keeps you up at night? That's what we want to know. What are the things, the 8, 9, 10 things that could cause this company to have some serious problems? This is what I have here. It's called my enterprise risk management list. For us, safety and security will always be at the top of the list here. We haul 36,000 carloads of, it's called toxic inhalants. Bottom line is you breathe it in once and it'll kill you. It's basically chlorine and nitrous ammonia. They're both very, very important in terms of our economy. They purify water. It's used in pharmaceutical productions. It's used in agricultural production. The best place, now I have to haul it. The government requires to haul us. But I believe the best place to haul this stuff is on the railroad. We're 10 to 15 times safer than moving business on the highway. So we do spend a lot of time on our safety numbers, and we've got a lot of technology we have today. We're working on a new train control system. You think about the autopilot function you have in airplanes today. We are right now experimenting. We have a new technology. We're running on some trains that the computer, onboard computer, literally can run the train. My number one safety issue today on train collisions, our employees fall asleep. We had an accident in California last year. Two men fell asleep, ran into another train, cost them their lives. Great men, great employees. But there's just a process and a challenge you have when you're operating the railroad to stay focused. This new technology would eliminate that. If you look at the next slide, we call this our kind of pig in the Python chart. You see a huge bubble here. Now, I was really excited to see the fantastic young ladies here this morning. I talked to them before we came in, and I said, listen, get your education, and when you're done, call me. I've got a job for you. And I mean that. We are in a situation at Union Pacific, and I think most of corporate America is. We're just happen to be a little bit ahead of the curve with the baby boomers retiring. What that chart shows you is the bubble we have. And what has happened in our company with the mergers we've had for the last 10, 15 years, we were doing very little hiring. And in a highly unionized environment, I have 13 unions, 95% unionized. When you offer buyouts with mergers, you offered unseniority. So what was happening? You weren't hiring in new talent, and you were buying out retiring people on the other end. Well, guess what? That day has come now for us to deal with it. I will lose in the next 10 years 25,000-30,000 employees out of 53,000. We have to interview 10 to hire one today. What's the number one failure? A seventh grade reading test and a drug and alcohol test. It's pretty sad, quite honestly, when you look at the difficulty we're having. These are great jobs. These are jobs that are in the 90th percent of industrial workers in America. Locomotive engineer earns $100,000 to $150,000 a year. They have some of the best benefits in America. And yet we're struggling to hire people because they can't pass a fundamental reading test. We have had to rethink how we hire, train, develop people. We have now one of the largest apprenticeship programs in America for any corporation. I have over 5,000 employees in basic apprenticeship programs. Carpenters, electricians, plumbers, great jobs. But we have had to, instead of us relying on outside to bring it in, we are starting our own programs to develop it. So, again, and I talked to a couple guys today. I was checking whether they want to come out of retirement. I've got a couple trains that maybe can operate for me long term here. But now we also have in that world, and I think, again, most corporations are facing this issue. Kids coming into the workforce have different expectations. I just had my top 450 managers in. We do an annual leadership conference, and we were talking about our hiring challenge. If you're under 30 years old today, you fall into a category called the millennials. I don't know if you've read about it at all. Each generation has a different name for it. I believe they all bring value into the workplace. Millennials today, highly technical savvy. In fact, this speech to them wouldn't work. They want to see visuals. They want to have slides. They want to have sound. Millennials today expect a much greater work-life balance. I have many kids that say, "You want me to work Saturdays?" No. And they're bright enough in many cases that they have choices. So we have had to approach our business to really kind of break the old mold to think about how do you attract, retain, and motivate a new workforce. And that's not a negative on young people. I really want you to come work for me when you're done here. But it's just something that corporate America has to rethink how they approach these kids. Now, I will also tell you, I've got some folks that have been there 35 years, and they've said to me, "You know what, Jim? I don't care. I'm not under 30, but I have the same issues in terms of how we think about work." So we'll wrap it up here. If you look at this last slide, railroad industry today is at a huge change point in its history. We've got demand that is exceeding capacity. We're finally getting price. We're investing like crazy. My first year as president, I went to our board of directors and asked them three times to kick up our capital investment. We spend 20 cents on every dollar that we bring in goes back into capital. It's the highest of any business in the world. Now, I wasn't certain my third time I asked our board to kick the capital up whether I was going to get out of there with my job, to be honest with you. There, a lot of investors are skeptical about the capital appetite for this business. But as David said, we've had a great return on our stock. We're doing our part in terms of addressing the transportation problems we have in the United States, and I'll tell you, it's all tax-free. The highway system is subsidized today by everybody in this room. We have no substation. It's all private money that moves in, but we have our commitment there. We have committed employees, and I think we can be part of this country continuing to be great going forward. I hope that was of interest to you today. I'd love to take some questions.
Thanks, Jim. Now we get to the interesting part of the program, the questions and the answers. Before we do that, though, this is really for Shirley. When you start looking for a new home down here, there's a booklet. When you start looking for a new home down here, Jim, there's a booklet on Marco Island, and here's another one for Naples.
Great. Thank you very much.
So welcome. Thank you very much.
I know
now
Shirley's
David Restmiller.
So. What's that? I know Shirley's looking. So.
Shirley's already been looking. Okay, David.
This is a one-liner. It's about fuel costs, and I'm going to put together about four or five questions. By the way, you're great with all your questions. Have any of you ever been to a Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting? Well, it lasts about 10 minutes, and Warren Buffett answers questions for about 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. We have enough questions that we could be here till 2, 3 o'clock this afternoon, and I apologize that we can't cover them all. First question relates to fuel costs, adding a few together. Union Pacific in the P&L statement last year, what was your total fuel cost, and what does 1 cent change in the price of diesel fuel do to you?
Great. We burn 1.3 billion gallons of diesel fuel a year. We're the largest consumer of fuel in North America, more than the U.S. Navy consumes. So if you do that math, 1.3 billion, every penny is $13 million of higher cost. Yesterday we were paying $2.98 a gallon for diesel. 4 years ago we were paying 75 cents. So the number, it's billions in terms of what's gone up. What's interesting though for me, the energy, while it's a challenge, it also really gives us a competitive advantage because we're about three times more fuel efficient than business moving on the highway. So it helps us when you think about competing with highway.
I have a couple questions relating to railroad stock purchases, both price, are stocks overpriced or underpriced now? Next, Warren Buffett has purchased some railroad stocks. Why hasn't he bought any Union Pacific? I can answer that. He owns some Union Pacific, but that's kind of the gist of about three or four or five questions, Jim.
Well, obviously, I'm going to be a little bit biased in the railroad sector, but I will tell you, I think yesterday or this morning, we were $120 a share. I think there's a great opportunity going forward in this industry. The number one issue is the ability to get some price. You're going to see a good quarter for first quarter for our industry. It's not a cycle. Our business is a little bit soft, but again, the value of products moving on the railroad today compared to where they were three, four, 5 years ago, it's not unusual to see pricing up almost 100%. And that's what's happening. And I don't see that changing significantly because we don't have a quick fix to transportation capacity in the United States. You're not going to wake up 5 years from now, we've solved our problems with the highways. Warren Buffett, living in Omaha, and I see Warren regularly. Last time I saw him, I said, Warren, you're making it tough for me to live here. I come home and on the headline of the local papers, Buffett buys Burlington Northern, my competitor, and said, you're making it tough for us at dinners in the community. He sees the industry the same way we do, which is an asset that will not be replaced. You'll never build another large railroad in this country. He sees the issue with transportation supply, the highway system, and he sees the opportunity in terms of investment. My issue with UP is simply one, we have not performed the last 15 years. The other guys have. He said to me, thinks we have the most upside, but he never makes a bet on management. What I would tell you, if you're thinking about it, UP is a great company to buy. Okay.
Several questions regarding, I'll call it economic indicators. Rail, car loadings are very important as we look out to the future on anticipated rail volume. And two or three questions about economics and what you foresee given what's going on with your company and forward contracting.
I used to have three full-time economists in my company. I decided since they were usually 50% right, I could probably do without them. So I quite honestly, what we do, in a lot of cases, we're leading indicators when you think about raw chemicals that go into, for example, the auto industry. We ship the chemicals that are used in producing plastics that go into autos. We ship iron ore that goes into steel production. It's pretty darn soft right now. Now, I've got businesses like coal that are going gangbusters, and it's going to continue to go gangbusters. There's a lot of debate on greenhouse gases, but the fact of the matter is in this country, coal accounts for 50% of electricity generation, and that's not going to change. We have to deal with some of the environmental issues. Agricultural products is one that's doing pretty well. We're now exporting. China, as you know, used to be an exporter. They exported grain, they exported steel. A lot of products, they're now an importer. So right now it's pretty soft. We gave guidance this year. I always have to think through these here because lots of lawyers help me run my business these days. But we said for the full year, volume would be up either 1% or down 1. Even with that, we're going to have an absolute fantastic year in terms of our performance. It's hard to look to the future out here. We're going to invest for growth. I have had some of my shareholders in Wall Street call me when we announced another $3 billion capital spend this year. They said, Jim, are you crazy? Do you see what's going on in the economy? The problem is, if I have to take a long-term perspective. If I respond to kind of a quarterly issue, we'll never deal with growth going forward. So we're going to continue forward building the railroad.
Another question, we have several coming on security, terrorist activities, the impact on the rail industry, if any, how do you protect from it? What's going on in Mexico with shipping cross-border? That's kind of a summation of probably four, five, six questions.
Great question. Obviously, 9/11 changed everybody's world. I had mentioned the two different things here. The chemicals we haul, toxic inhalants, are pretty dangerous. In fact, we have modeled a tank car chlorine, which is pressurized in the wrong location, could have 1,000 to 5,000 fatalities. We're seeing housing development build up around the railroad that makes that risk any greater, even greater. We have our own police force. We have federally licensed officers. It goes back to the Jesse James days, if you want to read the history out here. They're great men. They work very hard. We spend a lot of time on security. We're very linked up with DHS in terms of understanding where terrorist threats may come. We have protocols that if we see the risk go up, we will secure these chemicals, some cases with armed guards, to try to, in fact, we won't move them anymore. It's pretty serious, but I'll have to tell you, the railroad and tank cars today were not designed to withstand a direct attack by a terrorist. We, at the border right now, we have gamma ray machines. Every car that comes across the border, we look through that car. It's an x-ray machine, and we can look, and we look for people hidden in those cars, sometimes can get drugs. I will tell you, though, our success, I think we have probably about an 80% success rate. I have seen infrared photos, our special agents, cameras, trains coming across the border and stops, and you'll see people jumping and running across the border. We're spending a lot of money down there in terms of securing the borders, but it's a real challenge. The problem is Mexico is very important both ways in terms of business. We do $1.5 billion a year both ways. We're actually seeing more business, a jump in business moving from the U.S. to Mexico. A lot of people think it's all northbound from Mexico. We're seeing an increase in consumer products as the quality of living in Mexico improves. You're seeing a huge demand for consumer products produced up in the U.S. So we're working hard on it, and we're going to do everything we can, but there's no fail-safe mode right now.
I bet there are at least four, five, six questions on passenger traffic versus freight traffic versus what can be done to increase passenger traffic, and I think Jim's pretty well covered that in his remarks, but is there anything you'd want to say to kind of top it off? Just over
well, my only point, when you hear that, if you look long-term, it is a solution, but the federal government has to get serious about putting money into developing passengers. The policies are primarily focused on the highway system, but we're talking, in my mind, the way you do this is you literally build a separate passenger railroad, maybe right next to the freight railroad. We've got one example in Utah that they put about $500 million in to build a line. It was separated from freight. So you still have a freight railroad. You're not mixing freight and passenger. And I think that's what's going to have to do. But it will not happen. Passengers today, even in Europe, where some of the most successful passenger lines, they're subsidized 50% by the government. So that's what it's going to take, not only the investment in infrastructure, but subsidization in terms of handling. End of the day, though, it really is the right decision if we can make it work.
Touch on employee relations, union relations, feather bedding in the past, just kind of an overall three- or foursome question, whatever you might want to say.
Well, I mentioned we have 53,000 employees. 95% belong to one of 13 unions. When I first took over the company, we were in pretty serious trouble with customer service, with a lot of aggression with our union management folks at the local level. I spent a lot of time out. I would hold town halls like this. I'd invite North Platte, Nebraska, Colton, California, El Paso, Texas. We'd invite our employees in, their spouses in, and we talk through it. I committed to our employees that we were going to change the environment. In my business, and I things have to change. In the railroad business, the management style was really kind of one side down, very militaristic, no communication. You either did it or you were gone. And that's the style. Now there are other companies like that. We had to change that. I have a lot of very good young local union chairmen. But I'll tell you one story. I was out in North Platte, Nebraska. We had about 250 people in the room, and this young guy gets up, and he's all over me. And I said, listen, you want to get a fight, we can have a fight. Let's just keep it respectful in terms of what we're doing. He finally sat down, and we had a good meeting. Afterwards, he came up to him, said to me, he said, "Miss Young, you know, I think maybe we can work together. We do have common goals in our company, but I want you to know, every time I'm in the room with a group of employees I represent, I'm going to be all over you." And the reason is, the toughest guy gets elected, or person gets elected. And so we have to worry. We had a history I mentioned about the number of people on a train. But what I'm trying to point out is the only job assurance anybody has in my company is that we're successful financially. And there are many corporations in America today, GM, Ford, Chrysler, that have lost half of their employment. Their benefits have been cut substantially, and it is real. So we work very hard on that.
You comment on your remarks about what happened in California on the, I believe, the mudslide. We had several other questions about hurricanes, tornadoes, weather, how much of an impact it has on your business.
Well, it has a huge impact, in particular hurricanes. We operate all along the Gulf Coast, and we have to make a decision 48 hours out when we see the hurricanes that may hit to move equipment. We ran right through New Orleans. You look at the hurricane that came through there and wiped out that city. There's some great stories about we actually helped evacuate people out of the city on trains, running trains out to get them out. But it is, you know, I point out to our operating folks and our shareholders, I'm going to have snow and ice every winter. I'm going to have hurricanes. We just have to be prepared to deal with it.
Okay, I'm going to ask one more question, but before I do that, I'm going to ask Jim's wife, Shirley, to please stand. I'd like all of you to join me in recognizing Shirley for being here. And with Jim being gone 60% of the time, this is the lady. Final question, because I know the hands on the clock are moving. Whatever happened to the little red caboose?
Great question. Well, you know, cabooses were a sign of inefficiency over the years. They were really a function of labor agreements. They were actually outdated probably in the late, middle 60s. And yet we had cabooses operating in the property up through the middle 80s. A lot of them are sitting in parks these days. If you go around, you'll see around town. There's, you know, one of the great things in my business, something that may get out of date, I've got a lot of railroad buffs that love to have that equipment, boy, and they're always after it. But again, it's just an example. Technology replaced the caboose. If you ever see a train go by, you should look for this. Right on the back end, there'll be a little box. It's got a little antenna and a red light blinking. That's a radio that goes up to the computer in the locomotive. That does 90% of the work that a caboose did. Caboose was there in many cases, say, when they started pulling the train, that the back end of the train actually moved. And so they have